Blog Talk Radio.
When life seems to crush your dreams, so find your balance for all your needs. A little work, some family fun. Find your love, keep your life on the run. Told you how the story goes. So write your own script before you grow old. Live your life, laugh out.
Good evening and welcome to the Star Chamber Show live podcast. Episode number 403 has begun. Shout out to Far Cry for the great intro music that we so love. Thank you especially to Pete Fry, their lead guitarist and band leader. And it's a great Wednesday night here in Central Kentucky, where it was a almost spring-like day. And joining me tonight in the co-hosting chair is the lovely, vivacious, and loquacious Holly Phillippe. And Holly's already aboard. So, hey, Holly, checking in with you.
Hello. I am here. I am ready. I am ready for our tonight's guest.
Well, you know it's going to be a good episode. You know, when you open up the chat room and, you know, the first one in, of course, Tommy B. Smith. The man himself. And then like seconds after him, we had Sandy Lender, and then Sako Toomey has just checked into the chat room.
Yay!
So you know it's going to be a great night. You know, yeah, when you see Sako coming into the house, and you got Tommy and Sandy to lead the charge. Yeah, the chat room is working tonight. Gets a little finicky at times, so if it does log you out, just be sure to refresh, and that should take care of it. Yes, it's a live broadcast, of course, so there's always adventures, and yes, but no crazy weather tonight here in Kentucky. It was nuts, Holly. It's like spring. I loved it.
Well, I'm going to tell you, there's crazy weather in California. I don't know if you've been keeping up with it, Steve, but, you know, we told you about the Pineapple Express. People, check this out. It is a mess. I mean, we're talking Beverly Hills. We're talking Hollywood. We're talking Monterey. I mean, there was an atmospheric river, they call it. There was so much rain and snow that dumped at one time, it just had nowhere else to go. So it just made rivers. Crazy stuff.
Wow. No, I missed that part. Yeah, I was mired in a lot of the usual
crazy
lists of endless tasks over here today, and of course you know how that goes, but I guess I gotta get caught up in current events after the show. I'll scroll my news feeds for sure.
Yeah.
And hope everybody out west is doing okay. I did not hear about that. It's been quite the opposite here. It's been almost like spring weather, very unseasonably, but I'll take it. And Holly has entered the chat room also. We also want to welcome award-winning filmmaker and author Amy Lee McCorkle is in the chat room as well. So, yeah, great group building up there tonight. And, of course, the Star Chamber Show is affiliated with Imaginarium Convention. So we always like to keep you up to date on all the latest happenings there. And this week it's a little lighter than usual, but don't worry. We still got a couple of good updates for you as we added two excellent, excellent panelists to our guest roster. And those two folks are Terry K. Jobe, and she is an author and audiobook narrator, and then also the author, the man himself, Lee E.E. Stone, or as I like to call him, Lee of the Five E's. Yeah, they just got announced about a day ago, and they are aboard, and yeah, that guest roster keeps building, so go over and check out our guests and panelists when you get a chance. It is an amazing, amazing group. Starting from the guest of honor, five-time Bram Stoker winning, Jonathan Mayberry, and all the way down. And you'll see some of the folks in the chat room there too. You'll see Sandy, you'll see Amy McCorkle, you'll see Sako on there, you'll see Tommy on there. So you can read all about them too while you are visiting over there. So yeah, what a good group. But it's building up just beautifully. And we've got a lot percolating, and in the next few days we should be adding A nice batch of new panels and workshops. So I'll be getting those from Holly shortly, and I will get those up on the site. Hello, Moon. We got Dewan Hearn just joined in. So the group
in
is building
house.
Up here. In the house, yes. Yeah, anticipating our tonight's guests, who we managed to pry away from overnight Manhattan world for a night of podcasting and talking. So, yeah, that's I'm not going to tell you who it is, though, for a couple more minutes at least. So is there any updates or what do you got going on your end, Holly, before we get to the folks that brought us tonight's show?
Lord have mercy. I've been working on the press side of things this week, so haven't been heavy and to the Imaginarium side, but yeah, we do have a few updates and stuff that will be coming very soon. I will get back to announcing some more workshops and everything. Probably this time next week I should have some. Maybe not. Maybe toward the end of next week, because somebody's birthday is Tuesday and it's our anniversary. And Wednesday, Valentine's Day, which we're having a show, which is crazy. Mm. It's going to be fun.
Yes, I get it all, folks. Holly's birthday, our anniversary,
trifecta,
and Valentine's
baby.
Day. Trifecta, as I call it. It's running the gauntlet, as others may call it. But, yes,
a lot
of celebrate. Of course, it's going to be great. It's going to be, as I call them, holidays. They're holidays. A lot of fun.
They
a lot
are
of
holiday.
Fun.
Hello,
yes.
Trevor Hutcherson.
Trevor Hutcherson in the house. Wow, what a good group developing here tonight.
What a great chat room we have tonight.
Yes, I'm chuckling at Tommy's comment about the certain Foo Fighters, leader of the Foo Fighters, in relation to tonight's guest. That's awesome.
Yeah,
good one, Tommy.
Yeah, it's a holly jolly season. That's right.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But, yeah, we're going to go ahead and recognize the two folks that brought you tonight's show because they are both awesome. And they are Ren Garcia, a fine author of the League of Elders series, and, of course, Sandy Lender, the genre blender. And she's got a new one tonight for you to listen to. So we're going to go ahead and leave you in a little suspense and start with Ren. Ask that famous question at the end, and then we'll let you hear Sandy's new spot. Here is Ren.
The League of Elders dares to be unusual. It's easy to be swept away in this bold and uninhibited landscape where fantastic heroes become old friends and sinister villains inhabit every dark corner. Dare to explore things best left alone. Each book is your lantern, lighting the path to a world never before seen. So what do you say? Are you weird enough for us?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Ren. We are. We are. In a good way, of course. And, yeah, Ren, he's such a talent and wrote what I think and is easily the longest action fight sequence in literary film history and film history, whatever media you wish to go into. It's the longest fight scene ever. It's great. We talked about that when he was a guest on the show. Fantastic guy. And now we're going to go over and give you some new stuff from Sandy Lender. And, yeah, while you're listening to the show tonight, go over to Sandy Lender's YouTube channel and click that subscribe button and the little bell for all the notifications. It's free. Takes you only a few seconds to do. And she's got a great, great BookTube channel over there. So, but here's Sandy herself.
February is the month of love, and author Sandy Lender has something cynical and satirical with just the right amount of romance to make you swoon. It's Vampire Satire, set in the Rocky Mountains in her Fairy Holidays series. Welcome to the Rose Chateau, where ghosts and vampires team up with fairies against trolls and monsters. Check out the crazy adventure of My Fairy Valentine from Sandy Lender, wherever fine books are sold. And fall in love with vampires again. And if you just want some romantic read recommendations this month, check out the Sandy Says Read BookTube channel on YouTube.
Yes, folks, and yeah, you can't go wrong with Sandy. She's an exceptional writer, and I know Holly is always up for a good vampire story, no matter what month it is. But February is as perfect as any, especially with Valentine's Day.
I am a vampire 12 months out of the year, so, you know, it's always good for me.
That's true. And she's not kidding. Yeah, she's not kidding, folks. That's the Holly we know. And she's been devouring a new vampire novel that's next week's guest, as a matter of fact, from next week's guest, who I can I'll let you in on the little teaser, Ava Veritris. And she is awesome and has a new vampire book that came out this past year. And yeah, Holly's gonna have it done by next week. So yeah, she's in the vampire groove right now.
Yeah. I just haven't had time to read. We have had hellacious.
Well, don't give too many details. Some people may be eating dinner right now.
I'm just going to say that the stomach flu has hit the Zimmer house, and pray to the gods and the goddesses and whoever else is listening, the universe and karma, that I don't get it, Steve don't get it, and Beck and Jordan don't get it, because all the kids, two of the boys started Sunday night,
down
and then
to the count.
And then Addison started last night, and it has just been a sleepless week and lots of stuff. So yeah, the poor kids have been very sick, and we're on the other side. So crossing my fingers, it doesn't hit us. We have Lysol. You know me being my nurse that I am. I am Lysoling. I am using the bio stuff. I mean, I have sprayed everything that hands touch in this house. You know.
I'm going to make an extra effort to drink some extra bourbon as a disinfectant, just to be sure.
Kidding.
Just strictly
I'm not
as a medicine.
I'm ready to drink Lysol.
it wasn't too fun. Felt very sorry watching the younger ones go through it, but yeah, that's that kind of thing. It hits very hard and immensely, and then it goes. But I hope everybody out there see Tommy says he sees this thing as not just where we are, but it's been going around. So yeah, be careful, folks. Stay healthy. Yeah, because it's not fun, especially when you're having to jug work life and creative life and all those good trials and travails of the indie world. Yeah, you don't need to be sick while doing all that. So stay healthy, folks. But we promise not to give you detail. Promise not to give you details of all the stuff. It was kind of like watching one of those scenes in The Exorcist, though. That's about what I like in it too. It's not too much fun. So we got. Anybody want had something?
Sandy
any
Linder.
News in the chat?
Sandy Linder says vitamin B bourbon.
Yeah, exactly. It's that's how you get servings of vegetables, because bourbon has to be at least 51% corn. So that's how you keep up your servings of vegetables.
Trevor Hutcherson says, it's got to be at least 110 proof to eradicate those germs. So that's true. The more proof, the better the germ killer.
Yeah, we'll have to have bookers. Yeah, they'll have to keep a bunch of bookers on hand, because that's the class of bourbon that he's referring to, along with a few others. So, that'll definitely disinfect it. Not much can stand up to that fire. But no, folks, I'm well behaved. I'm well behaved. I jest, but I may have a little bit, of course, because. Hey, it's Kentucky, right? And it's one of my favorite things. But this chat room is active tonight, folks. If you are online, go ahead and dive in there. Yeah,
Moon says grab some Knob Creek. Yeah, Steve
grab
Steve
some
likes
Knob
Creek.
Creek.
He actually does.
And it honors a love it.
I prefer Blanton. Steve loves Blanton too, but
that's
I
my favorite
because I'm not a bourbon drinker. I'm a wino, as you all know, and beer, of course. You've all seen me with my pictures of beer. I love beer.
Yeah.
Good, cold beer.
Yeah.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, you all are welcome to send me Blanton's or Knob Creek or anything you'd like. It's all good.
You can
good.
Bribe him. for my birthday. Yeah, you can just just send me some wine, you know, over the interwebs and all that good stuff.
Yeah,
awesome.
Holly will not turn away. We will make sure Holly gets plenty of wine. If you're wondering, I saw Saka was asking, Holly's birthday is February the 13th. Which also happens to be our, this will be our 8th anniversary, and it's going to be fantastic because we always sit at the same table, same place in the Joseph Beth Booksellers Bistro that we had our very first date at. Every year we've done it, so now this will be the 9th time, obviously.
Yep.
But, yeah, it's going to be fantastic. It's always a great, great thing. It's a tradition. I hope to keep it for as long as possible, so Joseph Beth better keep bistro open and rolling and keep the layout of the restaurant the same. keep that table there, at least that table. don't move anything around.
Oh no, they can never move that table. We're going to have to put our name on it so that we can literally say our name is on that table. You can never remove that table. And a fun fact, I know Sako was saying the 13th. Yes, 13, my lucky number, of course. And I had turned 13 on Friday the 13th. I had 13 people at my party, my slumber party I had that night. And it was a full moon, which is a rare thing to hit exactly on Friday the 13th. So, I mean, it all coincided, and it made my little black heart very happy.
nice. Well, it looks like our guest is on deck, so I'm going to move forward to the introductions. Tonight's guest bears a striking resemblance to Foo Fighters' Dave Grohl, and who knows, it might be. You don't know. But, yes, he's a great, highly acclaimed author who has some fantastic works, such as the short story collection Slash of Crimson and Other Tales, and also the great dark fantasy horror novel Chains in the Sky, and he's got a new one cooked up for 2024. He's a Star Chamber Show favorite. He's an Imaginarium Convention favorite. Of course, I'm speaking about the one, the only, and we want more, Carl R. Moore. Welcome aboard, Carl. You're live.
He's playing us a tune.
He is.
Nice.
Now, this is a first. Nice.
His own intro. Oh, okay. How about that?
He cut himself off. He cut himself off. It dropped the call. So we give this fantastic intro, and then he's playing, and I guess, and cut him off. Oh, Lord. Here we go. We're going to try again. Carl,
hold
on.
I think my phone exploded.
It did. You cut yourself off. That was not us.
What up, Steven?
That was
got me now?
We got
gotcha.
You. You're live. There he is.
Fortune favors the brave.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right. And everyone was juiced up to hear some Carl Moore tunes. So that's a great intro. That is fantastic.
That was one of the,
well, you
that
know,
was one
it was
the best intros.
So I don't know. It was a chance to play with the electric guitar for a minute, but it is the only reason we're here, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's definitely one of the best intros ever, and he managed to cut himself off at the same time.
I managed to split the atom, I guess.
You did.
You're like the Hadron Collider.
That's how happy I am to be back on the Star Chamber show.
Well, we are
that's
thrilled,
right.
We did
and we
one
have
last
a
year.
Full chat room. We have a full chat room, Carl, waiting for you. They have been so excited.
I'm humbled. I'm really stoked. I've been looking forward to this. And last year was crazy. And we had a good conference and everything was great. But I've been chugging along full throttle here, trying to get stuff done. And feel like we're finally getting somewhere. Wherever we were last year, I think I started talking about this book last time we were on Star Chamber show, but I feel stoked now because it's really happening now. Like the manuscript is done and Red December will be out this year, and I'm really excited for this one. And all thanks to Seven Star Press for moving this project forward.
Well, thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
You.
But yes, first though, you want to give the audience at least a spoiler-free if possible. I know, but a little bit of a teaser as to what this novel is about. Which I happen to know this novel very well because I served as your editor on this project. So, yeah, I definitely got into the weeds on this, and I'm going to have to hold my tongue because, you know, I'm itching to talk. I want to talk about this.
Well,
one.
You are.
But
I guess
yes,
I can think of you as my first victim.
You can guide me into what we can talk about. I'll let you kind of take that because there's so much that I could say. I will say it's fantastic. People are going to be blown away. It's a tour de force. It's a thrill ride. It's intense. It's visceral. It's twists, turns. You don't know what's coming. It's awesome. So now that I've given you that kind of generic feedback, you can give us a little more specific picture of the new book.
Well, I'm flattered by your description. I think, that's the idea. You know, the last novel I did, Chains in the Sky, was sort of an urban fantasy, urban mayhem, and this one I feel like I'm coming back to a kind of wilderness that I know well, and that is sort of at the roots of my soul. This takes place in the deep dark woods. The title of the book is Red December, and it's a story about hunters and werewolves in a small town in upstate New York. Although being from Maine, central and northern Maine, there's definitely a similarity, and this forest that stretches across the North American continent, east to west, west to east, is the setting for this thrill ride and this kind of deep and visceral dream about the things that can happen in the woods. So really, the story is, you know, the premise is simple. There are werewolves in the woods, and these werewolves take over a town. There is a werewolf virus spreading, and people are turning into werewolves, and the authorities are coming to hunt these creatures down. But a group of hunters who happen to be out hunting when the werewolves attack kind of cuts a deal to say, hey, you know, if we can solve the problem with these werewolves, maybe you can spare the town the full onslaught of the authorities coming in Waco style. So it launches with the hunters trying to protect their town from the werewolves. But I think, you know, the difference is that at some point you get the werewolf point of view in all of this, and so it's not so much a paranormal romance type of werewolf story like we've gotten kind of in popular culture, like through like Twilight and this kind of thing. It nevertheless gives a perspective where some of the people from the town aren't necessarily against the werewolves having their say. So with that sort of backdrop, I hope get into it and get into the characters.
Yeah, and speaking of characters, I'd love for you to give a little bit on your main protagonist, because I found him to be a phenomenal character, and I'd love to hear you speak just a little bit on your main protagonist.
Sure. So the character that launches there are several main characters, but I'd say the protagonist that you're talking about is a guy named Cade Kershaw, who I sort of modeled after a lot of the folks I grew up with. I mean, the book's dedicated to my dad and a couple of friends. This guy is a hunter and a veteran, and he's kind of like a mashup of drawing inspiration from a couple of different people I know. But he's sort of that even-handed sort of outdoorsman expert who can handle a rifle, yet sort of respects the ecosystem and cares about the land. And so he's married to a woman who's an accountant who works remotely in the city from upstate New York. And he's sort of like the custodian of his acreage, and he takes at-risk youth and hunting on these hunting trips to try to give them a way of looking at nature as a way to find inspiration on kind of getting their lives together. And so he's sort of got this, he's sort of the strong character with a certain kind of heart for nature, which is something that I grew up witnessing and participating in, and has given me a certain perspective. I think the last time we talked about how I was saying that Chains in the Sky was a book that took place in New York City, but it really was New York City through the eyes of someone who saw an urban landscape as a type of wilderness. And urban landscapes can be wild, and they can be wildernesses with their own kind of ecosystems. And of course, what we think of traditionally as nature in the woods is also a wilderness. And this is about a character who kind of sees a certain divinity in that wilderness, but with kind of a cold eye. I mean, I don't think it's quite as romantic as something like, Walden Pond or this kind of thing. It sees something divine in nature, but it also takes into account the realities simply coping with the cold and the elements when they're kind of trapped in this landscape dealing with the werewolves, understanding and respecting the conditions that you're in is a big part of the vibe of the story.
Yes.
Did you draw? I mean, I'm curious of where you got the idea for the setting. And I know you have a cabin that you, like a hunting lodge, you go to often and like stay a weekend and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And hang out with the fam. And did you get the idea while you were up there camping?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So okay. Here's that. That's a good question, Holly. And so here's what it is. It's kind of based on two places, just like the characters are a mashup of folks I know. The setting is kind of a strange, dreamy combination of there's a family cabin we have up in Maine, my old man's place on Junior Lake, where a lot of the descriptions, I would say, come from. It's a similar kind, although slightly different forest. But then it's a place that belongs to a friend of mine, a musician friend named Fran, who's one of the guys that this book is dedicated to. He has some acreage here in the Catskills, and we would go down there. We haven't done it lately, but in years past, we would go down there to hunt deer in the fall, and he's got 26 acres in it, and it joins up with state land. And much of the landscape, like I could almost draw a map. I almost feel like the book needs a map with it, but maybe not quite as seriously as a fantasy novel does. But yeah, so it's 26 acres in the Catskills that I would go with him to, and we would spend, we would go there for, a couple of days or up to a week, deer hunting and get up onto the mountain on his property. And then sometimes also on the state land. And it's really like, it's funny because I feel like here in upstate New York, it's a gorgeous, and pristine sort of woodland that we have in the Catskills and the Adirondacks. I feel like it's kind of become obscure. If you go on TV, you see, these survival shows where people are parachuted into Alaska or someplace like that, and it's kind of Hollywood, and you get a lot of these settings in national parks when it comes to popular culture in the wilderness. But one of the things I find interesting here is that because it's sort of a forgotten landscape and quite empty, people don't think of New York as a place with these wildernesses. But New York City is only at the southern tip, and it's quite a large state running east, west, and north, south. And there's a lot of empty woodlands. And that same woods connects all the way to the boreal forest that goes through central Canada and on to the west. And then also touches another sort of woodland that comes down from Maine. The setting was taken from my buddy's acreage that borders this massive forest. And there's a certain in that landscape. You know, there are articles I've read recently about how some of the oldest fossilized trees archaeology for, woodland archaeology, some of the oldest tree fossils come from this forest that's here in New York State. And so we're talking about, you know, millions of years of pristine woodland and the all of the feelings that the land evokes from that history.
Absolutely. And yeah, notice that Carl did not say how he hunts when he's up there in upstate New York, but we'll get to lycanthropy in a minute. But the landscape, I felt like, to me, I mean, that region, those are old forests. Those are older mountains, you know, than as compared to other areas of the United States. And the kind of feeling of things ancient, and I'm not, just promise you, no spoilers, but that comes through in touches in this story, the feeling of something ancient and something old there. And some of that tradition kind of filtered over into your writing, if I'm not mistaken.
100%. And, you know, that's a good way to describe it. It's something ancient. You know, I was just looking up where I was talking about those tree fossils, and it's in Gilboa, New York, where there are 385 million year old tree specimens, according to their Gilboa fossils website here. And that's what I'm talking about. And that's not far from where we would go deer hunting and the descriptions of what's happening there. And there are also, you know, there are a few cave systems in that area. And so, yeah, the vibe of what's ancient and the idea of what we take for granted as the benefits of civilization versus the benefits of living in a wilderness landscape. You know, I feel like people romanticize the wilderness, and I guess a horror novel in its own way also romanticizes the wilderness and the woods. But what I feel like is the deciding on what is an ethical way of life, what's a valuable way of life, what do laws mean, what are the laws of nature versus the laws that of civilization, and in what ways is civilization itself kind of monstrous and wild and repressing things that are allowed to exist if you're living in the so-called wild. I think that the main character, Cade Kershaw, is sort of this even-handed hunter who's trying to protect his town, but then you also get the perspective, and this is one of my favorite things, and I remember talking about it a bit in the fantasy panel last year at Imaginarium, is the perspective of the villain. When you get the werewolf's perspective also, the werewolf character is another guy from the town named Ted Thetford, who kind of gets a raw deal from these real estate developers. And when you find the werewolf cult, when you get the POV of the werewolf cult and that group and why in many ways they're better off as werewolves in inhabiting this environment and more empowered, then things take a twist and the meaning of the land and the meaning of who and what's living on the land kind of changes. And another of the characters is Helga Kershaw, which is the main character's wife, Kate Kershaw's wife. She's an accountant and she's successful professionally, works in New York City, another landscape I'm familiar with. And she, her interactions with the hunters and the werewolves and where she decides to take her path, I think is another point of interest in the novel and another way of seeing how a character changes and develops in her perception of, you know, what she wants and what it means to succeed and what it means to live in a wilderness versus living in a civilized culture. So another character who I had fun with, there's one of the at-risk youth that Cade takes hunting is a character named Ethan White. And Ethan is a 19-year-old guitar player kid who gets in trouble [S2] Yes. [S1] With the police because he's a small-time, you know, weed dealer and petty drug dealer. And he gets in a little trouble, really just wants to go off and play his guitar, but he gets caught up in this caught in between the hunters and the werewolves and this battle in the woods, and he sort of he sort of provides some comic relief. And of all the characters in the book that might have a touch of autobiography in them, it's probably Ethan for me.
Nice.
His arc is another one that's funny, right? Whereas the other characters tend to be modeled on people I know.
Yeah, you definitely worked in a little nod to our shared love of heavy metal a little bit.
Yeah.
With him.
Right.
Which I absolutely
right.
love.
Well, yeah. Ethan's having
that's
a career crisis,
to,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
He gets
way
further.
To get to know your favorite authors is to read all their books.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, I don't generally write in the first person. I don't,
right.
Although Slash of Crimson certainly had some autobiography because it was mm-hmm. about a guy in a band in Portland, Maine, which was a whole mm-hmm. other landscape altogether. So there was certainly, because it's about a band and I played in bands in Portland, that certainly was a factor there. But you know, Ethan in Red December is, you know, he's not the main character, but, you know, he's sort of like the objective eye and sort of the comic relief getting his, you know, perspective on this apocalyptic mayhem that's going on in the woods between the werewolf cult and the authorities. You know, there's a certain kind of, you know, I mentioned like Waco for a second earlier, and I, you know, thinking about cults and thinking about the relationship between, you know, which is kind of at the forefront of our culture right now, like the idea of independence versus participating in civilization and kind of giving up certain amount of independence to be a member of civilization. This is kind of at the fore because it's sort of about whether or not they're going to let this town burn and whether or not it's worth saving. And so the cult and the authorities and Cade the hunter, they take it seriously, of course, as they should. And Ethan sort of like got a certain ambivalence as he witnesses it, trying to decide, you know, he wasn't getting anywhere on either side for a long time. So it's really just a kind of a story of his survival as well. But
it is a story of survival. Yeah. On a lot of fronts.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah. You know, I see different things in the media that sort of echo the vibe that Red December is going for, like, you know, and this is another element that I think about a lot. When I wrote Chains in the Sky in New York City, it's horror, but it's like there's a heavy crime noir element in the book. It's sort of in that book the cop is hunting a demon in New York City, but the demon is perceived as a serial killer in Brooklyn. And you know, I don't know, you know, like true crime has become very popular. If you go on YouTube and you go on the internet, there's a lot of true crime going on and crime noir that mixes with horror.
Or if you live in our house.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, one of my favorite authors in that crossover genre who passed away, unfortunately, but whose books I really love, his name is Tom Piccirilli.
Absolutely!
Like, Headstone City, and all these great books. And he was another guy who kind of saw similarity in urban landscapes and wilderness landscapes. Like, A Choir of Ill Children takes place in like a kind of like an Appalachian holler and small town, verging in the kind of middle of nowhere setting. And then Headstone City is in Brooklyn, and a lot of his other novels are in New York City. But there's that sense of the wild things that can happen in both landscapes. And so in Chains in the Sky, there was, although it's not true crime, it's a work of fiction, Sligo Beach in that novel is a thinly veiled version of Gilgo Beach. And it touches on the things that, and at that time, you know, the Long Island serial killer had not been discovered and detained as he has now. So I was living in New York City during that time when this was this kind of ambiguous menace in the city. And so that novel touches on that vibe. Whereas Red December touches on, like, if there could be such a thing as woods noir, like there's an idea of If anybody is a fan at all of David Politi's or 411 mm-hmm. Missing or that kind of thing, the idea of the kind of eerie things that happen in the woods and the things that aren't so innocent, you know, like Skinwalker Ranch kind of vibe and that sort of thing. Like the idea that there are kind of things being perpetrated that are not necessarily just accidents happening in the
right.
empty places of the world. And so Red December is very much shares a sort of kindred spirit with that idea. You know, like I can remember being at my dad's cabin occasionally. I had one time I was up there with my buddy who is one of the guy who owns the 26 acres in the Catskills, but we were up at Junior Lake in Maine. And I remember a warden come stepping out of the woods in uniform, and we were standing by the cabin, and it was just the three of us, and the warden was coming towards us, and it's never good when a warden's coming towards you. He's in our world, I'm like,
no.
Really. I looked at the other two, and I was like, well, I guess there's only a 30% chance it's me since it's these guys, so hopefully it's not me he's looking for. But he came, he was looking for a guy who was missing. He was looking for a guy who had wandered into the woods. And he was asking if we had seen him, and he described him. He was a guy from a town that was from Lincoln, which is about an hour away from Grand Lake, which is near where our cabin was. And we didn't, unfortunately, have any information for him, but it was a reminder that even though we were just there kind of hanging out on the lake, cracking beers and relaxing, it could very quickly turn to a situation where somebody is in peril. And so, it's kind of like, and I don't know if I mentioned it last time because, you know, this book's been a little bit longer in the making than my other books. I had two relatively close together, but this is a longer novel. And so my second appearance here on the Star Chamber show, I think I was, you know, in the middle of writing it last time and here we are at the end, but it has spanned this whole year. In the spirit of creepy things that happen in the woods, I mentioned the author Algernon Blackwood, who wrote a story called The Willows, which is often cited as like early cosmic horror, certainly an inspiration for H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah,
The Willows.
I don't know the
author, The Willows.
Yeah.
He also wrote The Wendigo, which is kind of one of his claims to fame with the line, my fiery feet, you know, like, which was about a moose hunt in Canada. So there's a lot of Algernon Blackwood vibe in this. And one of the things about The Willow is that story takes place in Europe. And it's kind of interesting because in The Willows, it's two guys taking a canoe trip on the Danube going east. And it's, we don't think of a wilderness story being in Europe. We think of Europe as pretty, you know, developed now, and there aren't many wild spaces left, at least that come to mind in popular culture. You know, I was just in Scotland and they're trying to reforest, but you don't get the vibe of endless wilderness necessarily at first glance. But like in a story like The Willows, where they're paddling out of Germany and paddling east, even places where you see farmers and you see that there are people, it's almost like you can develop a landscape and then it can get forgotten again. You know, in America, we think of like Rust Belt and urban decay and small towns with declining populations, and it gets spooky. It's like the woods got settled, and then it kind of got unsettled. And then so like in the wilderness, in the Willows, they go on this canoe trip, and they're going east on the Danube. And as they go and they reach these various flood basins in the river, they start to feel cut off, and they start to have these kind of hallucinations that harken back to pagan deities from Rome and Central Europe, and sort of these spirits of the land that come out and begin to haunt them. And the willow trees become sort of the symbol of this wilderness reclamation. You know, that's something that I feel like doesn't get emphasized a lot. You see a lot of movies, you read a lot of books that either romanticize the purity of nature or that talk about how nature is getting destroyed by humans, but you don't get a lot of the power of reclamation and the idea that once civilization comes, it's not necessarily permanent, You know, like nature and wilderness can strike back, and it's always there, and it can be hidden when civilization blankets it. But a story like the Willows, or the kind of vibe I'm looking for when this werewolf cult starts in this town, is the idea that you know, the change is multi-directional. You can settle a place, and then you can unsettle a place. So on that note, you know, I thought that could sort of connect to the sort of vibe we're getting in popular culture when you see a lot of these, what I'll call woods noir.
Woods noir.
Crime noir in the woods. Woods noir, yeah.
I think
love
you just
it.
Coined
yeah.
a new term. I think Amazon needs to add that as a category.
I do too.
Fantastic.
Woods noir.
That's awesome.
That makes me want to write a good woods noir.
Yeah, woods noir, folks. Write that down. Carl R. Moore.
Well,
yes.
It'll be interesting to see if, you know, it'll be interesting to see who, you know, like we get like a lot of villain POV in urban fantasy and so forth, where folks identify with vampires and lycanthropes. There's certainly in the romance novel world, that's a popular sort of thing.
Right.
I feel like, you know, I used to remember sometimes I would see blogs. I think I saw it on I saw it some years ago on Keen's blog. I would see things. I would see tropes about people trying to put the fangs back in vampires, with the idea that vampires have gotten a little bit civilized and have gotten a little bit, you know, heavy on the romance side with the danger being subtracted a bit. So if that's the case, this is certainly this story I'm writing is certainly one where the werewolves pull no punches, and the kind of romance, if you call it, the way they breed and the kind of culture. You know, I did a little research on wolves, and I also did a little research on cults, and the way the werewolves kind of like breed and feed is a sort of visceral kind of, if it's romantic, it's a visceral romance, and it'd be interesting to see how people identify with either the hunters or the werewolves on that level.
Oh yeah. You're in for a treat, folks, on that front.
Well,
good stuff.
Since I've never gotten to be on live network TV, I thought it might be fun since Red December takes place in the woods. I made a quick list of my top 10 creepy moments in the woods, and maybe you guys have had some creepy moments in the woods. If you want to jump in on it, are you guys game?
I'm game.
Sure.
Go
yeah,
ahead.
Absolutely.
All right. So, if you read Red December, then a lot of the descriptions in there kind of draw on various experiences, though. You know, it's not, like I said, it's not really autobiography, but the setting certainly draws on them. So I've had a couple of strange things. And also in the spirit of the Willows, like, it's not necessarily like being in the woods and being attacked by a mountain lion that necessarily is a creepy experience, right? It can be subtler than that, although that could be bad too. So without further ado, so here's my number 10 creep.
Kitties.
If you get attacked by a kitten in the woods and you don't have your antihistamines.
Right.
But like, yeah, so you get attacked by a kitten in the woods and you have no Claritin.
Fever.
Yep. So all right. So number 10 is my dad found a witch hat in an abandoned house when he was hunting. So when I was about sometime when I was a kid, and I wasn't really little, but I remember him coming back from a hunting trip, and, you know, my old man, he's a very rational type of dude. He doesn't like fiction, which, you know, I find kind of quaint and endearing in his own way. Like, he won't read any work of fiction. He's like, you know, he was in the Marine Corps. He was a business teacher, voc ed teacher, and then he did a lot of hunting, spent a lot of time in wilderness. Wilderness was his thing, and he he doesn't have any superstitious bone in his body. But he came back from a hunting trip one time, and I guess I must have been 12 because I was already kind of skeptical. So I was really surprised to hear him say, you know, I was walking around with my buddy, and we were in our hunting territory, and we came to a spot in the woods where there was a house. the house had been built pretty far outside of town. I mean, there's towns around these hunting places up in Maine, but the town itself isn't really near civilization. So then the house that's outside of the town, you know, you're lucky if you have electricity kind of thing. So anyway, they find this abandoned house and decide to take a break and have a sandwich while they're deer hunting. And they're kind of poking around, and he said, you know, the basement was just like, the first floor was totally caved in, so you could see right down into and this house was like totally collapsed. And he said, it was just, you know, I felt funny standing in this house because it seemed like it would, it seemed like it kind of could collapse at any minute. But what was strange is I kind of poked my head in the kitchen, and there was like, in the kitchen, there was an old coat rack, and on the coat rack, there was a black conical hat that was brand new, not a smudge on it, with a pointed tip, and a black cloak hanging on this coat rack. And he said it was like something out of a movie. It was like, you know, one of those conical classic witch hats, like, you know, I guess they're alewife hats or something from history, like the women who sold ale would wear them, and that's how they became
one.
Holly,
you
have one. I figure you're the expert on this. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, so one of those, and that was just hanging in the house. And he was like, geez, you know, it seemed strange because everything else in the house was totally trashed. It was totally abandoned. There weren't any other houses around. And there was just this one cloak and hat hanging on the rack. And even, you know, even then, even I was skeptical. I said, Dad, are you pulling my leg? You know, I'm like, you know, but I think I was fairly old by the time I got that story. It might have been 12 or 13. So I thought that was a very strange kind of thing, and it makes you wonder, even if it's not a supernatural kind of issue, whether it is or isn't, just the fact that it's there. I think the thing that I found creepiest about it was that he described it as being new and unsmudged, as if it had just been hung there and, you know, like rather than had been hanging there and was kind of beat up like the rest of the house. So that was number 10. Dad finds witch hat in the woods. Ha.
Nice.
So, nice.
Number 9 creepy moment in the woods is, this is going back a few years before. I was maybe 10 years old, and the old man and his buddies were cracking beers up in Orono, Maine, and talking junk. And it was, you know, must have been fall. The sun was setting early. Sun goes down pretty early up there in the fall, you know. And then so there was – this is in the town. This isn't by the cabin. This is – we lived in a town called Orono, Maine. It's kind of a small town. There's a university there anyway. So it's fairly civilized in Maine. You know, Stephen King lives in Bangor, just a few miles down the road. So it's, you know, it's kind of civilization there. But, like, if you look behind his house that's in the town, there was a huge field that connected to a Christmas tree farm and then some woods, and there was a radio tower. And so he said, hey, you know, I dare you to walk to that radio tower. And it was pretty foreboding because it was, you could see this red light in the distance, and you could just, you know, to walk there now that it had gotten dark, but it was an early dark in the fall, and it was just this thick darkness. And I was 10 years old, and I was by myself, and we're talking maybe a mile and a half, so not super long, but long enough in the dark by yourself. But, you know, it was a dare from the old guys, and so I was like, oh, okay, I got to have to do this. So I walked all the way to the freaking tower. I walked to the tower. I didn't bring a flashlight, which was dumb, but I guess there was enough moonlight. I remember it being pretty dark, but my eyes adjusting. And I'd walked to that tower before, but it was a really lonesome, foreboding walk across a field, up a hill on a path. And I remember thinking to myself, like, vulnerable I felt in the only moonlit wood, going up across a flat field, up a small hill, over the hill, and down to where the tower stood, touching the tower and coming back. And, you know, and then, you know, the cherry on the sundae, of course, is that when I got back to the house, I got there and I was like, all right, I did it. I touched the tower. And they're like, oh my God, we were just kidding. Did you really walk all the way out there? I was like, oh, man.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so there's number 9 creepy moment, right? So now we'll switch it to the acreage where we hunt. And this scene is definitely inspired the book a bit. And it was after we had got – my buddy got a deer in 2014, and there was this major snowstorm. And the snowstorm I think Buffalo got like crazy, like 8 feet of snow or some crazy amount of snow. Yep. And we had dragged the buck down the mountain like as that snowstorm was coming in. And we hung it in his shed, and then we drank some scotch and went to bed in a good mood. And then for some reason, it was very eerie. I woke up at like 6 a.m, and I had this strange feeling. And I was still in my pajamas, but I put on my boots and my winter coat and grabbed my rifle. And I walked outside to the and climbed up into the kid's treehouse on the edge of the yard, looking up the mountain to the acreage. And from there, I saw what looked like a serpent coming down the mountain. It was like a furry serpent because the trees did not have any leaves on them. And so you could see the snowy slope of the mountain. There was like, you know, maybe a couple of feet of snow on it. And I saw what looked like a furry serpent moving down a giant furry serpent moving down the mountain between the trees. And what I realized, you know, I looked through the scope. You're really not supposed to use them as binoculars, but I had to do what I had to do in that moment. And so I looked through the scope and I realized that it wasn't a serpent, but it was a troop of coyotes, nose to tail, coming down
nice.
The mountain with the leader in the front, you know, and the way they moved had this like wavy, like it kind of like S curved down the mountain in this sort of like hypnotic wavy pattern to make it look as if all the coyotes together were one animal. And it was kind of serpentine. It kind of slithered through the snow and it was striking. You know, and so I realized, of course, they, you know, we field dressed the deer and left some guts on the mountain and dragged it down to the shed. They're following the blood trail. So they were coming down to check out the deer. We didn't want them in the yard, but I didn't want to hurt the buggers, you know, like, so I was like, you know, I looked at the leader in front and it looked like a giant German shepherd. It had like a black and gold coat and it was just the freaking largest coyote to ever seen. These were some well-fed coyotes, you know, and that guy. So I gave it a warning shot. I shot the tree next to it. I thought they'd scatter, but they didn't scatter. That leader just perked up, kind of ticked his head to the side and kind of like looked down in the valley like, all right, I get it. You have a gun, but I'm not going to panic. We'll be back. And then he turned and they all turned with that lead coyote and went back up the mountain. So that was striking to see them all move in unison and not panic. Power of the wilderness to reemerge. It was a potent moment. So I don't know how much time we got.
Oh, we got time.
Are we?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Got time.
So I'll blow through another couple of them quicker. Number seven was snowmobiling back from West Grand Lake to our cabin, going back to Maine. This was with my grandfather, whose name was Carl. He was actually more of a coastal guy up in Maine. He had a lobster boat and that kind of thing. But he would come up into the woods with me. We'd all go ice fishing at the cabin. And this one is creepy and yet also just kind of funny. We went out to this. We snowmobiled about 5 miles, maybe you know, give or take, to this from Junior Lake to this large lake called West Grand, which is like just this huge, you know, multiple square mile lake that gets hundreds of feet deep. And we're going there for big lake trout, you know, trying to pull some like 5 to 10 pound or more lake trout through the ice. So we spend the day ice fishing and we come back and a snowstorm kicks in and we're in a caravan of snowmobiles going from one lake to the other down this stream. And it's a frozen stream and we're on the stream and like, I'm sitting here, I've got my arms wrapped around this 84-year-old dude who I know has been drinking whiskey all day. And I'm like, oh man, like, why do I have to be on granddad's sled? This is crazy. Like, you know, maybe I should be driving. And then my dad's up ahead and we get down this stream and we get to the second lake where the cabin is. And I sort of can still see as we're emerging onto the second lake, but then the whiteout is to the point where I can't even see where we're going. And I'm like, oh great. We're going to be on David Politi's now. We're going to be the missing, you know, like it's over, like, you know, and this of course is the 1980s, right. You know, and I'm a kid and I'm like, oh no, we can't see anything now. It's just snow in the headlights beam. I see my dad. He's kind of not too far. He turns off to the left and I poke my grandfather and I point to my dad and I'm like thinking, you got to turn. Cause he's going to the camp, you know, you got to turn. Like, got to follow him. He knows where he's going. you know, and Gramps is like kind of waves his hand like, oh, the hell with that guy. He didn't know what he's doing. And I'm like, oh, man, that's it. We're done. So we just continue into the blizzard. My dad goes off to the left. And then I'm like, I don't know where we are, you know, and I can't see anything. So eventually he stops the snowmobile and we get off. And a couple of the other party were still with us. And they're like, I don't know. Where's the camp? Where's the camp? Do you know? Donnie went off to my dad. You know, he went off to the left. I don't know. Should we go there? I go over to take a leak. Right. I go over to take a leak. I walk 10 feet away from the sleds and I kick something and I realize it's the porch of the cabin. And my grandfather's like, you know, sitting there like, I told you so. And so I couldn't even see the cabin until I walked 10 feet to take a leak. And we like practically crashed into the cabin, you know? Yeah. 45 minutes later, my dad comes back and he's like, oh, I headed off into the swamp. I don't know how I took that wrong turn. So, you know, he didn't know where he was going. Yeah. So there is that one. So then, number six, we got sawdust quicksand in a swamp in the Stillwater River. As a kid, I was growing up in Orno, and this one figures into the novel because there's a swamp, in the novel, but, we would not even on a camping trip, just on a regular day after school, we'd run around in the woods behind the town, you know? And so like, I remember finding like off the river in this swampy area. I don't know if it was the sawdust came from the mill or it was just natural rotting from the trees, but like I took like maybe a 5 or 6 foot limb that had fallen from a tree. And there was this, like, it looked just like wet sawdust spread in front of me and I needed to walk across it. And I took this limb and I pushed it into the sawdust and it just sank and it swallowed the whole thing and disappeared. So I don't know how deep that stuff was. I had stepped in it and it like went up to my knee. So then I had decided, you know, to give it a test, and it swallowed the whole branch. So I decided I'd have to find another way back. Cause if you stepped in that, you can sink.
Wow.
So then, yeah. Number five is, one thing I always found very creepy is being up at the cabin on the lake. When you turn out the lights, and maybe you guys have experienced this if you've been camping, although camping, you know, moonlight on the tent, but in the cabin, when you turn out the lights, and this was in my Jack Ketchum blog. When you turn out the lights, it's so pitch black you can't see your hand in front of your face. So falling asleep in that, yeah, it's nice, you know, like because you can sleep deeply in that kind of darkness. But opening your eyes and having it be that pitch black, there's a certain power in that, you know, in witnessing that day in and day out and not taking light in any way for granted has an effect on the mind.
Well, it's complete blindness. It's feeling blind.
Yeah.
I mean, you're completely blind.
Yeah, and absolutely. And understanding that the universe owes you no light. There's the sun. There's other stars. There are things you can burn. There are inventions you can create that light up. But in the end, the universe owes you no light.
That's
yeah,
right.
So then number four is jumping forward. When I was 18 or 19, acting like a fool with my buddies, we went down to Kenduskeag Stream in Bangor, Maine, which is made popular in our world by a guy named Stephen King, who wrote a book called
It. Stephen King.
Yeah.
Yep.
Stephen King wrote a book called It, and in It, there is a place called the Barrens. And the Barrens is a kind of wilderness in that book, where they have all the fights where they're pelting each other with rocks and there's the sewer and the clown and so forth. It's eerie to me reading that book because, you know, as a teenager, we hung around the Barrens. We hung around where Kenduskeag Stream comes out of Bangor, Maine, and we're very much similar to those kids in that book. And so it's eerie looking around there. I've been back to visit a few times not too long ago and thinking about that clown and those Barrens. But one time, me and my buddy, what was interesting to me is, and Stephen King's a great writer and I love his work, but like what's interesting to me, and I go into this in a blog, is that Stephen King's characters are a little sweet for me sometimes. There's a lot of nostalgia in his books where there's a lot of, you know, the kids remind me of a Norman Rockwell painting, you know, like there's a certain kind of like apple pie Americana there, which is great. But what strikes me is that the crowd I hung out with, it's like we were the good kids and the bad kids rolled up into one. Like, and I felt like you know, we went down there this one time, and we were kind of older teenagers by then, and there was this girl kind of hanging out in her leopard skin skirt while everybody was drinking beer, and the boys were getting teenager chesty, and everybody was, the temperatures were running high, and I guess she kind of, this girl kind of liked my buddy, and the guy who kind of liked her was getting unhappy about it, and so I was like, poking my buddy, like, we got to get out of here. And we were standing on this pylon on a bridge, like a, I don't think it was a train trestle. I guess it was like a footbridge across the Kenduskeg. I don't know what kind of bridge it was, but we had gotten off the bridge like the geniuses we were and decided to stand on the trestle above the, or rather the pylon, this bridge support that was above the running water. So if a fight had broken out and somebody went flying off that would be it, so to speak. You know, we would float too, as the line from the novel goes, because it would be done. But at any rate, the fight didn't break out. I managed to persuade my buddy that we should go back up the hill. We went back up the wooded hill, heading back to our psychedelic dungeon of our first apartment, you know, like where we lived on Ohio Street, again, not too far from West Broadway where King lives. But we're coming back up the hill from the Kenduskeg stream, and this, you know, this other gang of dudes start coming down the hill, and I realized that the guy behind us who had almost started the fight was running back up the hill to try to inform his buddies that, you know, to attack us. And so I was like saying to my buddy Sean, I was like, we got to hurry up, we got to get up here. And we actually passed through this wave of dudes that were coming down and just kind of nodded and waved hello and kind of got past them before the other guy got up to tell him, like, you know, that he had our number and he was coming after us. So that was a very, that could have been a lot worse than it ended up being. We managed to make it across and across the field before they turned around to pursue. But by then we were far enough off, but that mm-hmm. could have been bad. So there was another creepy woods moment, and that one not far from the Finn's house. Huh. So then another one, and this is one I had put up on Facebook recently, and this is maybe not scary. This was actually kind of speaking of sweetness and nostalgia accused Stephen King of Norman Rockwellism. Here's one of my own. I paddled up to a moose on Junior Lake. So I was in a kayak one time on the same. This is on the same stream that we had snowmobiled through the blizzard on, and this is in the summer now when it's not frozen. I was off maybe 2 miles from the cabin and a lot of miles from anywhere. And I was paddling back from this blueberry patch we go to. And I saw this moose standing on the side of the stream, and I took the kayak and I just paddled up to it. And I stuck the tip of the kayak between its hoofs. And I just kind of looked up at this moose, and this moose could have like stopped me if it wanted to, but it never occurred
That's
to me
awesome.
that it was going to bother me, because I certainly wasn't going to bother it. I was just saying hello. And you know, I've heard stories about moose being scary and moose being dangerous, but this didn't feel dangerous. I just stood there. But what it did feel like, and there is a little creepy factor here, is just you could just see the immense power of this animal that still existed in the wild. You know, it's not a zoo. It's not tame. It's not a zoo. It's sitting there munching treats on the side of the stream. And it's, you know, totally not worried about me, because it's outweighs me by a ton, you know, and it has this huge rack of antlers on it, you know, like, and even though it must have been late summer, I don't know, but it was, you know, this was quite the beast. It was a classic, you know, well racked moose standing there, and served as another reminder of the power of the reemergence of the wilderness. So now we're at number two already, which is this time teenager, same guy I was down at the bridge with. We were snowshoeing across. We decided to snowshoe into the cabin instead of riding the snowmobiles, because we were hippie teenagers and we thought it was cool to do it naturally and not use the gasoline, right? So we told my dad, we're like, get out of here with your machine. We're going to snowshoe 7 miles into the camp. We thought we were cool. And it was kind of cool. Halfway through, three and a half miles in, we stopped and ate a chunk of cheese and looked at the stars, and we're like, oh, it doesn't get better than this. We're standing here on the ice and the stars are overwhelming. I don't think we saw Aurora Borealis that night, but it's not unusual to see it. Anyway, so we got there, and the old man in his mercy came back out on the sled and said, hey, you guys want to ride? It's getting cold. It's going to snow. You sure you don't want to ride? We're like, no, get out of here. You know, we can do this. So he's like, I'm not coming back out. We're like, all right. So he goes back to the cabin on the snowmobile, and we keep walking. And when we get to the big lake, we can see the cabin at the end of the lake, just a little light on. And I'm like, okay, it felt like we were near it. But as we started walking across the big lake, we realized it's just not getting closer. And we walked and walked and walked. And this is another one of those, you know, and we were following the snowmobile track, but the snow was starting to come in now, and the snowmobile track was filling in. And so if the snowmobile track's gone and the snow gets thicker and we can't see the light, we got a real problem. But we were moving along, and it dawned on me, this is what happens, you know, like an alien spacecraft did not descend on us to abduct us, but this is how people vanish, because it turns quickly from, you know, what's going on and you feel safe to, you know, I don't know if I'm going to make it out of this. I don't know which direction to go. So as we were going along, my buddy said for a moment as it started to snow, I'm just going to sit down and rest for a minute. And that's when I kind of freaked out. I was like, no, no way. I was like, you know, get up. Come on, we got to get going. And so we hauled ass at that point, and we made it into the cabin. Like we finally made it across, 7-mile hike in the snowshoes, very cold, snowing at the end. Finally got to the cabin, and we were like just reheaded for the beds instantly. We were done. Of course, the old man had to tease us, you know. He was like, oh, you guys ready to play cards? You want some food? We're like, oh, what's the matter? You guys seem tired. Huh? But, yeah, that was another warning. And so then here's my number one creepiest moment. And so then this is something that I think Red December, this is the kind of vibe that I really feel like it touches. I was at another buddy's house up in Maine. This guy was a lobsterman. He lived on Monhegan Island, which is a locale that H.P. Lovecraft sometimes mentions. But he lived on Monhegan Island, which is an island pretty far offshore in Maine. Many stories about that unto itself. But he had moved from the island onto the mainland and gotten a house by a lake because he had changed from being a lobsterman to kind of an engineer for boat batteries. But anyway, he made a homestead by this lake. And this is not wilderness by any stretch of the imagination. This is near Damariscotta, Maine, which is kind of, you know, there's woods, there's a lake, there's Damariscotta Lake, Damariscotta Mills. There's like, it's kind of like farm country-ish and also mm-hmm. near the coast. So you don't feel right. like you're in a dangerous part of the woods necessarily, you know, but wilderness area. But you like, mm-hmm. but having said that, still kind of like, you know, you're far from Portland, and Portland isn't a very large city anyway, but you're kind of like, we were just sitting in his yard. We had cooked some dinner, and it was after dinner. We had a little fire in his yard, and we were just drinking some beers, and it occurred to me that, like, between his house and the lake that his house is near, there's maybe an acre and a half of woods that are just empty. And it's funny, you think about the meaning of wilderness, because this is like an area where maybe 4 or 5 old farmhouses have their property. And it's maybe like a strip along the multi-acre strip along the edge of this lake. You realize that because it's kind of private property and it's a little bit ambiguous where one property ends and begins, nobody ever really goes in there. And he had cleared an area in his yard, but as I sat there, and it was kind of getting later in the night, and the fire was burning down, and we'd had a few beers in us, but we were in some whiskey, and it was getting, you know, towards time to have a sweet dream, you know, and I actually, when I go to his house, this is about, you know, how do we start this off when kittens attack? I'm allergic to his cat, so I sleep in a tent on his lawn when I visit him, right? So, like, I have my tent pitched, and so it's always a little eerie because I'm like, all right, I'm going to sleep in a tent, you know, like. And I like sleeping in tents. There's always the thing in the back of your mind when you're sleeping in a tent, you know, there's this feeling that you may not, there's no door to lock, you know, like you can't lock a door in a tent. So you're out there, whatever's out there, you're out there with it. So it's getting late and we're sitting there. And I think, you know, several of the people by the fire are already snoozing in their camp chairs. And I'm looking into the woods, and I go over, and I kind of walk to the edge of that little patch of woods between the lake and the house, and I hear this sound, and it's like this snorting sound, and it's large, and it's deep. It's like, right? And like, mm-hmm. and I was like, what is that?
What,
you know,
that?
And I've heard deer snort before, bucks
yep.
can snort,
yep.
but this thing sounded huge. Could it be a moose? Could it be a bear? I don't know. But like, I kind of had taken I'd walked 10 feet into the woods, and I looked for it because it seemed like it was so close, and it seemed like it was, and I heard like a footstep like move in the brush, and I heard the snort again. And I was like, there's something there. And I went back and I told my buddy, and then I went back to the edge of the woods. I was like, there's something there, and it's making a noise, and it's big. I said, like, have you heard it before? What is it? And then I think there were cracks about Bigfoot or whatever. I'm telling you, this thing was, I have good directional hearing. My eyes are falling apart, but I have good directional hearing, and I feel like I can, I've heard animals move before and pointed right where they're going to step out, and they step out right where they step out. So I felt like I could tell where this thing was, and I felt like I could tell that it was huge, and I couldn't for the life of me think of what it actually was. So clearly what it is a werewolf cult, and you get to read about mm-hmm. it when the book comes out.
Nice.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing.
So there we are. And that's the top said creepy moments in the woods.
Love
That's
it.
Awesome. And on a Stephen King note, he also wrote a book called Holly. So there you go, coming full circle.
Yeah, right. I think I just got that. I haven't read it yet. I haven't cracked it yet.
Yeah. I got that
well,
on the release
date. You can't grow up in Maine.
Obviously, yes, with Holly on the title.
That's right.
And if you, and I'll teach you.
I'm looking at it sitting on my shelf right now. Yep.
Let me teach you a neat trick. If you hold the book so that your hand covers the word King, and you'll see Stephen and Holly. It's amazing.
You're right. It's right there on the side.
Right.
Stephen
there.
And Holly. Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating?
Well,
oh, man.
Know, you can't write horror novels in Maine without that without Stephen King coming up. But you know,
no.
I'll be restarting my Deep Dark Night blog, and I'm gonna possibly add a video, true crime and horror noir dimension to it. But having said that,
Woods
there is an
Woods
entry
noir.
In there.
Woods noir.
Woods noir, right. Well, that's a woods
yes.
noir, yeah. Frozen
yes.
horror and woods noir.
Right.
Having, you know, said that, I did a blog entry some years back on the difference between Stephen King's Maine and Jack Ketchum's Maine that kind of explores this idea of wilderness versus small town horror,
mm-hmm.
Which is at deepdarknight.net if anybody's interested in checking that out. But that blog entry kind of moved around. It got on top five horror posts for the week with horror.co.uk and had some attention when it came out, and kind of some of those anecdotes I touched on tonight. But you know, I really find it interesting the way the wilderness can affect you, and the way it can be monstrous but also empowering and reemerging. You know, I don't
right
a lot of the horror that comes out now, like it's fun, it's interesting, there are a lot of great allegories about how humans are neglecting the environment, and that's great, and you know, that serves a purpose most certainly. But I maybe this is where wilderness horror kind of merges with cosmic horror, the idea that, you know, not romanticizing wilderness and the idea that there's a price to reemergence. It's dangerous. You know, you can be with the hunters or you can be with the werewolves, but either way, you're going to have to face the consequences of what that state of being brings.
Exactly. And Carl, I've got a surprise for you. I have one of your readers that's been waiting on hold here to ask
yeah.
a question of you. So I'm going to go ahead and bring a quick phone call in from a reader to ask you a live question. And this is Trevor Hutcherson. and he's going to be coming on right now. Trevor, your mic is on.
All right. Oh, hello.
Hey,
there
Trevor.
You are.
Hey,
hey,
hey
man,
Trevor.
How you doing?
Well,
how's
just
it going,
one
man?
Question. On the cover of the Slash of Crimson, you have an SG on there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Me being a Gibson guy, why not
right.
another, you know, Gibson or like Les Paul or whatever? I'm guessing because it's kind of a similar-looking guitar.
Yeah, I can tell you. I can tell you how that came to be. The first, Stephen, help me. The artist who did that first book,
Aaron Drown.
Right, Aaron Drown had put a Fender Stratocaster on the cover, right, and it was a red and white Fender Strat, nice guitar. But I was like, when I saw the draft, and I'm pretty easy, you know, Stephen can attest, when there's editorial comments or whatever, I'm usually like, go for it. I'm so stoked that everybody's on board that I'm pretty pliable. So, you know, do whatever you want. But he put the Fender Stratocaster, and I said, you know, this is about a heavy metal band. And I don't go into great detail about what kind of guitar the character plays in that book. It doesn't really come into it in that regard. But he put this Fender Stratocaster on there, and I said, you know, that's a little too Woodstock. This is a heavy metal band. This is a story about a heavy metal band that's haunted by a demon. You know, the guitar player's mistress is a demon. And I don't think a Fender Strat is really the guitar. So I had suggested like a Dean, you know, like I was looking at like a Dimebag Daryl Dean guitar and or something like that. And Aaron came back with, well, you know, okay, maybe. But he said that might be going too far in the direction of it might turn off some readers if it's too metal, if it's too hardcore metal looking. You know, you might want to get something that appeals to readers. So then I was like, okay, that's a fair point. So I was Googling around, and I have a buddy who plays an SG, the guy I was talking about earlier, my hunting buddy who owns the property. And I was like, oh, those SGs, those Natural Cherry 68 SGs and stuff, those are perfect. And yes, Trevor, you're right. They have those natural-looking devil horns, right?
So Angus like, Young, you know, AC/DC. Yeah.
Angus Young, right? Yeah. So you can't you can't lose. So I said, how about an SG? And Aaron was like, you're totally right. That's what it is. And so he embraced it, and he made it rock. He made a fantastic cover. And with that red SG is like, you know, it's an iconic guitar, and it has made the cover. You know, I feel like that cover has done a lot for that book, just the cover alone with that cool guitar on it on the rock with the scratch marks.
It's kind of iconic. It's a, you know, it's great. There's a reason that the SG was my starter guitar, Carl.
Yeah.
Will.
Well, I don't even, you know, I've always like, I never knew what SG stood for, you know. Some people say it's Spanish guitar for the SG, you know, like, and maybe you guys have it, but yeah, when I was a lad playing and my buddy got his SG, it was sort of that hybrid between rock and heavy metal, right? Because it has the extended fretboard. They have long necks, you know, but they're also kind of that rare bird. Certain guitar players play them, like Angus Young plays an SG. Robbie Krieger from The Doors played an SG. Tony Iommi plays an SG. You know, and so it's certain guitarists, but they're guitarists who definitely left the name on the history of music. So like they,
I won't keep you much longer, but Carl, I'm going to bring my beater acoustic to Imaginarium this year. So if you want to pack something, we'll hook up.
Most definitely.
Fantastic.
What I need is to get the Imaginarium guitar to keep it Imaginarium. I'll get it monogrammed Imaginarium, and we'll have I'll have an electric
nice.
And acoustic.
There you go.
That I'll keep in Kentucky.
There you go.
Fantastic.
Awesome to hear from you, Trevor. We're looking forward to seeing you this summer.
All right. Sounds good, Carl.
Right on.
Take care.
Take care.
Thanks for the call, Trevor.
Take care.
Yeah. Night. That's awesome. A little interlude with a story I did not know. And Aaron also happens to be a big metal fan. So interesting that he had that kind of insight on that, because Aaron, as a music lover, would have no objection to a Starbody, Dimebag Darrell kind of guitar. And I actually have a Ibanez X body like that myself from the 80s. So I love that style. But that's right.
Yeah,
and Aaron, I always think of Angus Young because the horns, and of course on the Highway Hell album, of course, you have Angus with the devil horns right on the cover, so it fits perfectly.
Aaron's a pro, you know, like he knew what he was doing. I don't think he had a problem with the Dimebag guitar so much as he was like, you know, always thinking to broaden the audience and the impact, and I think he was right, you know, like, so
that's neat.
Cool.
I did not know that
looking
story.
Looking forward to seeing him again.
I was there during that whole time, and I never knew that story. It's fantastic. I just knew that when the cover came
cover
through, to me,
out,
it was like, I was like, oh,
so
this is
good.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, but that is awesome.
Seven-star press, you know.
So cool.
One of the strengths of Seven-star press is the book covers are always so badass.
They do look good. They do look good, and they read, and they also read very good too. I might add, you're not gonna be disappointed. But we are going to go, folks. I am going to warn you, folks. Yeah. We are going to go a little bit over the live show, just because Carl has had such an awesome show tonight. But there's still a couple little things I do want to cover with them. So make sure that, you know, live show does run out tonight. Be sure to stream, download the what we call the bonus territory. But before that, but quickly for the live audience, though, quickly give your whatever handles or websites that you want to give real quick, just so they can connect with you while the live show is still going.
Okay. So my blog is www.deepdarknight.net. And that you'll see there's tons of book reviews on there and essays and links to my books, Flash of Crimson and Other Tales and Chains in the Sky. You can also find me on all of the social media sites, Facebook, Instagram, the artist formerly known as Twitter, all of those. I'll be ramping up the blog again soon, hopefully starting a video blog for Woods Noir and the connection between horror and true crime. So lots of good things to
fantastic.
Come. Look for my new novel, Red December, with Seven Star Press.
Yes, and as of tonight, we're going to take over a hashtag Woods Noir. I think it's perfect. So we're gonna launch that. I think that's a great one that Carl has come up with tonight. But I do want to shift over to your werewolves, because I have a passion for shapeshifters in all their forms, in literature and film and everything else. And of course, you know, The Howling is one of my all-time favorite movies. I love all the different styles of werewolves, whether it's, you know, the type they have in Underworld, the Lycans, or where they have the ones in Howling, which are, tend to be my favorite. You know, the ones, you know, you have the walking wolf-headed kind of creatures and other variants, and of course, Dog Soldiers, other great films, and, you know, the Gary Brad.
Yeah,
their Howling novels were great. I mean, there's just so many. Yeah, and that, speaking of, great woods, creepy woods setting type film there. There's so many variants, and it's hard to kind of put your own little twist to it. What I found really interesting about your novel, and I want to leave this little teaser because I'm not going to get into it myself, and I'll let you reveal what you can. Your werewolves are different, and they do have a unique twist and your own stamp on them in how they're presented and their physical appearances and they're unique. It's something that people that enjoy the genre and werewolves are going to find very fresh, very different, and in a lot of ways, I think, very a little shocking in some ways. But I'd love to comment on, you know, your inspiration for the kind of werewolves you have in this and how much, you know, you can reveal about them.
Well, yeah, thanks, Stephen. I think you articulated that well. And I think that I'll put two things out there and see what you think, and hopefully this will serve as a teaser. But, you know, the main villain in the book, the lead werewolf, his name is Ifang. And Ifang, you know, the name is the name speaks for itself. Their bodies, and so here's the other component the way these werewolves appear, you know, they become werewolves through a kind of virus, right? They infect each other by biting. It's sort of like rabies. And so the virus doesn't, you know, some of the werewolves come out like at different levels of completeness. So the strongest, such as Aifang, their bodies morph into physical appearance and a physical structure that gives them a kind of advantage when hunting and when fighting. And so Aifang has a very distinct alteration to his body that I think, you know, speaking of book covers, I don't know if we want to reveal it, but there is, I was envisioning a werewolf villain and thinking of all the villains we get from books and movies and how say Freddy Krueger's claws are iconic. And so for Aifang, the lead wolf, some of his natural weaponry is unique and it's a kind of mutation. And so the other thing I was thinking is that the other influence to these werewolves is John Carpenter did a remake of a movie called The Thing that we all know. And in The Thing, the way the monster kind of is a shape changer and not just a lycanthrope, not a lycanthrope, but it's able to mimic other life forms. And so although this werewolf virus doesn't mimic other life forms, the idea that it kind of regenerates and changes in the creatures is something I thought would be fun and interesting and make them a challenge for the hunters and for the soldiers that are sort of trying to deal with this problem. Because, you know, werewolf lore is very much about like the silver bullet, you know, like, you know, monsters have a way that you kill them, vampires, it's a wooden stake, et cetera. And so the lore for werewolves is a silver bullet. And so in Red December, there are specific ways in which you deal with these werewolves and how they regenerate. If you simply attack them, you're not going to be able to easily stop them. And their bodies are able to kind of mutate and change in specific ways. So that's cool that you noticed it. And I was trying to go for something new with the werewolf genre. But hopefully, and particularly for the main character of the werewolf, the main villain, there is a treat to his physiology, I guess, that makes him kind of fun to write and to work with.
Oh yeah, and when you get into your descriptions, I mean, it's wow, it's striking, and yeah, you paint a great picture, and it's yeah, and yeah, and it's in some cases jarring, you know, with some of these fellows that you encounter in your woods.
Well, yeah, I wanted it to be unsettling, and it was part of that anti-romanticization of nature. You know, I didn't want nature to just be this, like, you know, pure thing. I wanted it's kind of dirty, you know, like, and it was also partially inspired by reading articles about how these wild pigs got loose in upstate New York, and we were starting to have a wild pig problem because the werewolves kind of have these minions that with the wild pigs, and they and so there's a certain way in which this virus takes off and with frightening consequence.
Yeah, it's definitely a fantastic thrill ride, and definitely those that like, you know, visceral horror and, you know, a lot of atmospheric type of elements. And, you know, I did mention, you know, a protagonist, but you're right, you know, there is an ensemble. And also the other thing I think you did really well in this novel is it's not without its emotional touches. And you do have characters that you care for quickly, and they're not even major characters. Some of them are minor, and things happen. And then also with some of your principal characters, you have some good emotional punches that really get you in the feels too. And I think that's the mark of, I think, a really good horror novel. So it's not just shock and awe, but also has a nice pathos and, you know, moments that you can, you know, feel a lot of empathy and some heartfelt kind of stuff too. And it's mixed in there. And I think that makes for a great story. But it's, I'm looking forward to seeing what readers think of this one.
Well,
and I think it's going to be a very good one.
You know, I appreciate your description. I'm glad that came through. And yeah, that's the idea. Mm-hmm. I like an action-packed novel, but I think the trick is action with depth of character, which can be tricky, but that's the goal. And so, you don't care if you don't care about the characters, you know, and the villain, any good villain's got to be a little sympathetic. So, you know, mm-hmm. Ifang, he's a terror, but at the same time, I try to go into the point of view there so that you get some anti-hero elements where mm-hmm. you start to feel that sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are lots of examples in recent memory. You know, you have like, you know, the Joker movies, several of, so, you know, the Batman series goes pretty far in different movies with the Joker. But that's the idea. I don't, you know, with varying degrees of success to my mind, but like, mm-hmm. but there are also, you know, Game of Thrones has a lot of great villains who you end up sympathizing, you know, who you start out kind of hating, and then you kind of start to root for them in their own way, you know, then so like, so that's the idea you get, you know, so I was, you know, some of the characters in the book, Ethan, for example, move between the villains and the heroes, so to speak, kind of fluidly, and mm-hmm. are kind of like, there's that gray area. So hopefully that comes through, and hopefully, I'll be really interested to hear how readers respond to Ifang and Helga and Cade and where their motives take them.
You bet. And this one, we are on all systems go to get this one out before Imaginarium. So,
that's
you'll
right.
be looking for this before midsummer in print and ebook. So that's going to be a lot of fun. And before we wrap up this amazing show tonight, I do want to give folks a little look ahead. Once you complete this project, do you have any itch for what you are going to be writing next? And if so, can you give us a preview?
I got more horror novels in the pipe. And I'm going to be I've got some grimdark fantasy books that I'm thinking of also putting out. That's something to talk about in the future. So, but I'm moving forward with well, let's just say that I've got another one in the pipe involving a banshee. I've got another one
nice.
in the pipe involving a very unique kind of murder. I don't want to call that a murder mystery. It's more of a let's call it woods noir. No, but it's I have a possible, hopefully a unique spin on the serial killer novel titled Devil's Mandolin. So
fantastic.
All of that loaded up with the most awesome publisher, Seventh Star Press, and
well, thank you.
Yeah, so very, very stoked about all this, and huge thanks to you guys.
Well, thank you, and thank you for giving us a preview. I'm excited about all of that. That sounds amazing, and I'm glad you're you know, in a good groove writing wise. And yeah, definitely, folks, pick up Slash at Crimson and Other Tales, a great short story collection. Chains in the Sky, which you will absolutely love, dark fantasy horror, urban, like you said, urban fantasy type novel. It's really, really good. And of course, Red December coming out in probably midsummer.
All right.
It's going to be great. But Holly, I'll let you, is there anything that you wanted to cover, Carl, before we say goodnight and let him go celebrate?
I just don't know. I think we covered
Holly,
about everything. The only thing I'd like to ask, Carl Moore, is if you plan on, in the future, possibly, I may give you an idea, of having a heavy metal guitarist that is a werewolf story.
Well,
there you
go. That's getting a little too biographical.
Yeah, that's pretty close to home, Holly.
I'll write that if you bring your witch hat to Imaginarium this summer.
Well, I can do. I will do.
Deal.
I will bring that.
All right, it's a deal.
A deal.
Right on.
All right. Always good to instigate more and more as far as his work.
Right on.
But any final things that we did not cover tonight you were looking to get across? Anything that we didn't touch on?
Just all my thanks. Looking forward to launching Red December and looking forward to Imaginarium and the whole Imaginarium family.
You got it, man. Well, thank you, and I raise a bourbon toast to you, and I will go ahead and turn this over to Holly to close out with you, but thank you for joining us tonight, Carl. It's been a blast, as always.
Thank you.
Thank
My
you,
pleasure,
Carl Moore. And thank you, Holly, for being my first cult member. Yeah, that's kind of a side secret thing. But yes, thank you.
Right. Well, I'll make a good lieutenant. The lieutenant always makes it out of the burning building.
You're third right.
All right. No. I thank you, Holly. Thank you both. You guys are the best. Looking forward to seeing you soon.
All right. Take care, girl. Night, man.
All right. Take care. Good night.
Good night, then. Okay. Join us next Wednesday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Another great guest. Another great chat. Learn a little, laugh a little, and have some fun. Create something great this weekend. And we will talk to you next Wednesday. Good night.